Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I'm here with the one and only Kelvin Holley. Kelvin has just an incredible resume as a guitar player and as a musician, as a super talented guy, and he's done things that, you know, any guitarist would want to have a little piece of his resume, let alone having all of it. He's been the lead guitar player for Little Richard for 20 years, spent 25 years with the Amazing Rhythm Aces, and he's been with Peggy Young and the Survivors for the last 10 years, Peggy being Neil Young's ex-wife. He's played and recorded, with, of course, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bobby Bland, Wilson Pickett, Billy Preston, Neil Young, Bonnie Bramlett, Kris Kristofferson, Billy Ray Cyrus, Billy Bob Thornton, Demi Lovato. Man, what an eclectic mix here. Klaus Voormann, Johnny Halliday, the Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section, Donnie Fritz, Dan Penn, Billy Swan, Ronnie Wood. Yes, that Ronnie Wood, Steve Cropper, Tony Joe White, Greg Allman, and Percy Sledge. Kelvin, thank you so much for coming on the show and for your patience. I appreciate it, man.
Hey, man, it's great to be with you.
So let's talk about Little Richard first. How did you hook up with him, and how the heck did you manage to stay with him for 20 years?
Well, long story short, I was in a great, I still am, it's a great band called the Decoys that was started by veteran Capricorn Records producer Johnny Sandlin. And I spent, it's close to 30 years now playing with those guys. You know, of course, a lot of them have passed on, but we're still, you know, carrying on the torch. But long story short, probably early 90s, we started playing a lot over in the Shoals area. And mainly every Tuesday night at this club here in town. And we kind of built up a following. But I met two or three of the guys that were actually in Little Richard's band, you know, and we became friends. And before too long, I think Richard had decided he wanted a second guitar player. And his guitar player at that time being Travis Womack. But anyway, I get a call one day, and it's Little Richard, you know. And
he didn't start the phone call like, woo, Kelvin.
No, but at first I thought somebody was pulling my leg.
Yeah, of course.
Because I was actually on the other line with a friend who's and I was consoling them.
Oh.
And it was right at the time when they just started call waiting, you know, which was kind of a deal. You could see who was calling you. And it was a strange number. So I went over and changed over, and it was him. And I said, really, who is this? You know, he goes, no, baby, it's Little Richard, you know. So I hung up with my friends, got on the line. He goes, you know, my boys tell me that, you're a great guitar player or whatever. And can you get on a plane tomorrow and fly to Los Angeles and meet me, you know? So I said, hell yeah, I can, you know. So I flew to L.A. and I met him. I spent about an hour with him in the room talking, and I played a show that night with him, playing with the Temptations at some performing arts center out there. And I just, you know, I stayed with him, you know, and it just worked, you know. I mean, I don't know, Once you're in his band, you know, you really, really got to fire yourself.
Oh, he's a real loyal guy, and
he's a real loyal guy.
That's awesome.
At least he was to us, you know. Yeah. I mean, you got to pull some stuff like not show up for gigs, or, you know, come on stage drunk or something crazy like that, you know. Now, I know back in the day, his brother Robert, who was managing him at the time, actually fired Jimi Hendrix, you know.
Well, yeah.
For that very reason. So.
Coming on a stage hammered.
Yeah, or that, or not showing up. Or,
yeah.
And thus, in later years, Richard, his band consisted of two of everything. Two drummers, two bass players, two guitar players, another keyboard player, horn section. So, I mean, so if somebody couldn't make it, then at least he had another guy, you know. So that's how, and then I think James Brown started doing it too.
The two of everyone.
Yeah, two of everything, you know. So,
do you have any funny Little Richard stories? And also, like, what was the weirdest Little Richard story you could share?
God, there's just so many, Craig.
Talking, I'll start listening.
Some of them I can't. But, you know, I mean, Richard was, he was a funny guy, man. He was just like you would see him on TV, you know, a lot of times. You know, like one day on the bus, I had a sandwich and it had onions on it, you know. And so he comes up behind me and he goes, Calvin, what you eating, baby? He goes, you know, he stuttered a lot, but he would say, boy, you got a lot of onions on that sandwich. He goes, you know, an onion is a medicine. I said, yeah, Rich, I heard that. He said, you know, you eat an onion, you won't get no bunion. But just stuff like that, I mean, it would just crack you up, you know.
Just like random weird.
And, you know, and Richard's a God-fearing man, you know. I mean, every show we played, he had boxes and boxes of these Bible verses in a nice little book. And he had a picture of himself in there autographed. And he would actually pass them out during our show.
To the spectators.
To the whole crowd. I mean,
wow. There could have been
thousands of people out there. And they would... until they couldn't go anymore. And he had two or three guys that traveled with us, his brother being one of them, and they would pass the books out.
Wow. So he was like, that was a pretty expensive cost, but I'm assuming he figured he was doing like mission work almost.
Absolutely. And you know, the story of him giving up rock and roll back in the 50s.
No.
And going to seminary school and actually becoming a preacher. Yeah, he gave up pretty much performing from like 58 all the way up to maybe 61. And he went to Oakwood College over here in Huntsville, Alabama, and became a minister and actually started preaching, you know, and then got back in it. And that's how he ended up going to Hamburg, Germany, and meeting the Beatles and all that. The Beatles actually opened up for him over there. That's how the Beatles also met Billy Preston.
Which
is a story in itself, you know. But anyway, back to this God-fearing man story. We were on a flight back home from Europe.
So wait a minute. That's a big entourage, two of everything.
Oh, man, we'd have anywhere up to 22 people traveling with us on a plane. And, you know, we always flew, very rare. Only time we were ever on a bus was if we were in Europe or somewhere, you know. So
how is he making money, or was he just able to command such a premium?
He didn't make much.
Yeah, I was going to say, man.
You know, he lived the way he wanted to live. The past 30 some odd years, he's been living in hotels, you know. So
wow, so that's a rough life.
Yeah, well, his logic was always... well, you know, if I buy a house, I've got to hire a plumber. I got to get somebody to keep my yard. I got to pay this. I got to do that. And you check into a hotel and you don't have that.
Yeah. I guess if it works.
Got room service, maid service. So.
Yeah.
It just makes his life easier, you know.
Sure. So go ahead. Sorry, I cut off your
stuttering. But anyway, we're on this flight from Europe, and Richard, he would always say a prayer, but we hit some turbulence. It was pretty bad, you know, over the Atlantic Ocean, and some of us were in the back of the plane. We could hear some commotion going on up in front of the cabin, and I kind of went, God, that's Richard, you know. So Richard fell out into this praying fit, you know, but he was, stewardess actually came back and got me and our band leader and brought us up to where his thing was, where he was sitting. And he was up there, you know, God blessing the hydraulics and the pilot and the co-pilot and the wings and the flaps and the wheels. And, you know, I mean, naming every part of the plane you can think of. You know, just freaking out, you know, because we were bouncing around pretty good, you know. But anyway, it was pretty funny. Him screaming like a white lady, as he used to call it. You know.
Was he really that excitable all the time?
A lot of times, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was just a funny guy, man, and just had a good heart and just a stand-up guy, man.
What did you get out of that experience in working with him? Like, in observing him or watching him?
Well, I stood right next to him. I was right by the piano, and a lot of times he would talk a lot sometimes to the crowd, you know, and I would just kind of give him a look, like, okay, let's play, you know. But one thing I have to say about Richard, when he felt bad or something may have been bothering him, he would always come out and give 110% to the performance. He would not leave that stage until the crowd was flipping out, you know. And a lot of times, you know, we would do these European tours, and it would be with Chuck Berry or Jerry Lee. There'd be three of us on the bill. And no offense to the other two, but Richard would just blow them away.
Yeah.
You know.
You mean energy-wise?
Energy-wise, appearance-wise, you know. I mean, Richard.
Yeah, he was impeccable with his dress.
He was always decked out, you know. And when he would brag about Michael Jackson or Prince or all that, you know, I mean, it was the truth, you know.
Yeah. So. Did you ever see, you know, Chuck Berry? And I'm not looking for gossip at all, but Chuck Berry was known for being extremely volatile. Did you ever see any of that kind of stuff?
On occasion. Yeah. It was like, you know, one day Chuck was your best buddy, and the next day he'd kind of act like he didn't even know you.
Yeah.
You know, and one particular story was the only time Little Richard and Chuck Berry ever performed together on TV was Jay Leno. And Richard and Chuck always kind of had this competition thing going on. I don't know if it was more on Richard's behalf or Chuck, but Richard asked me to come to the dressing room and said, watch me for the ending tonight. I said, okay. So then I get out towards the stage. It's like 5 minutes after Chuck had asked me to tune his guitar, so I did. Of course, his hands are so big, and the way he bends strings, he was never in tune.
You know? Yeah.
So, but 5 minutes before we go on, I'm standing next to Chuck. He goes, watch my leg for the ending.
So they both tell you
so
this.
So now I got Richard and Chuck telling me to watch them for the ending. And then right when we're going out, Leno's production guy comes up and goes, are you going to help me cue the ending? So now I've got three guys in the mix, you know. I think it's on YouTube. You can watch it. It's pretty funny. But so we get out there. Richard sings the first half. Chuck sings the second half. I see the guy out by the camera motion me to end the song. So I turn around to the drummer, and we end the song. Chuck's leg comes up. Richard's hand goes up like they're ending the song, you know. So It was pretty funny, man.
So when those two toured together, you guys were Chuck's backup band?
No.
This is only for the Leno show.
That was just on the Leno show, but you know, Chuck would always pick up somebody.
Yeah, he'd pick him up at the wherever he was playing, right?
He didn't know any of them. Every now and then he'd bring Jimmy, his bass player, with him, you know. But for the most part, it was whoever the promoter got to back him up, you know.
Do you think that sorry, go ahead. I apologize.
No, I just can't tell you how many times the guys that were going to back him up would come up to me or somebody in our band and ask us what they were going to do. And I'm like, you're just going to watch his leg and play Chuck Berry songs, you know. So.
Do you think that had to hurt his performance over the years? I mean, everybody was coming to see him do his thing, but man, you know, it kind of helped.
Well, I think Chuck just basically showed up and did his thing. You know, a lot of times. I can remember one night in Germany or somewhere, but Chuck is supposed to go on at 8:30. And, you know, 8:30 comes up. The guy, there's still crew on the stage setting things up. The house lights are still on. All of a sudden, I hear Chuck starting Johnny Be Good. The band's not even on stage. But it's 8:30, and he's supposed to start. So he didn't care, you know. His contract called for 8:30, so that's what it was. So everybody's rushing around trying to catch up, you know. House lights go down, the band runs on stage, and, you know, that's just the way he was, you know.
So he start at the time and finish at the time, and that's it, no exceptions.
That's it, man. Cash money.
Give me your cash. Yeah. Before you play, you got to get paid.
That's right.
In cash only.
That's right. And he would pull his shirt out of his guitar case, change shirts, and put his little sailor cap on, and there you go.
Wow. You co-wrote a lot of the songs on Peggy Young's last album, Raw.
Right.
And that album sort of chronicled her feelings about her divorce from Neil Young, as I understand it.
Pretty much, yeah. I pretty much, it wasn't a joke or anything, but we'd kind of called it her divorce album.
Yeah.
Something that she had to do, you know, and, it's part of the healing process, you know. So,
what was that co-writing experience like? And have you had other co-writes or songwriting experiences aside from that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, songwriting is it can't be forced. It's just something that just you pull out of the air, you know, or where the cloud. We'll call it the cloud. In Peggy's case, you know, a couple albums before this one, you know, she pretty much kind of had some chord changes and melodies. On this one, she didn't. All she had were lyrics. So we had done the Stagecoach Festival out in California, and she had asked me and Spooner Oldham, who's also in Peggy's band and played with Neil forever. He's a legend.
Muscle Shoals guy, right?
Hall of Famer. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, he's the keyboard player. But she'd asked Spooner and I if we would hang there in L.A. 2 or 3 days and sort through some of the lyrics, you know. So they came down to my hotel room, and she had all these stacks of lyrics, and she laid them out on the bed. And so I just picked up a stack, and at first, because I'm a rhythm guy, I like rhythm, I would look at the lyrics and try to feel a rhythm of the lyric. And I would pick up my guitar and just come up with music, you know. It was just coming out. It just came out, you know. And there was a few of the lyrics, you know, we had to change. You know, it got a little too much, but we changed the lyrics around, and man, we wrote like, I don't know, 13, 14 songs in like 2 days. I mean, it was just...
So you're in a zone, man.
Yeah, I mean, we were in the zone, and it was just, it just felt natural, you know. And then we went back to the ranch and got in the studio and tried to, you know, sort them all out, you know. So, yeah, it was great.
Was it weird initially with the subject material?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
well,
sure.
You know, when you're in a band, you know, you're a tight-knit family when you're together. You know, you're not just making music, you're friends, you know. So it was painful to see her and Neil, you know. And on top of that, you know, because they're in the public eye, all of that, all of the tabloid stuff, and you know, then you have to deal with that, you know. It's being a celebrity is not an easy job.
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, it's awful, you know, to a lot of degree, you know.
Well, any kind of failure or, you know, anything less than, hey, the world is perfect, you know, it seems like everybody jumps on it. It's like when Neil came out with that, you know, their divorce, of course, that was so, like, you know, all that drama was aired and,
right.
I don't even watch stuff, but I just like hear the periphery because I don't pay attention.
Well, sure,
to that.
Can't avoid it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we all knew that it was going to happen at some point. They tried to keep it as personal and private as they could, but you know how it is. It's just, but we were all kind of prepared for it, and as much as you can be in a situation like that, but all we could do is just sit back there and be there.
Sure.
For any kind of emotional support we could provide, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a tough situation to go through.
Yeah.
For each one of these artists, if you could talk about how you got the gig and maybe some cool or interesting stories about working with them, that would be great. I'd like to go through the list of every one of them, but I can't. But we'll be here forever. But
yeah, well, some of them were just one-off. Some of them are more than that, you know. So.
Billy Preston. Funkiest guys around.
Yeah, I actually did with him two or three sessions in L.A., and that was with Richard. Our bass player in Richard's band was actually in Billy's touring band back in the 70s and 80s, Charles Glenn, great, great bass player, based in there in L.A., but... I'm trying to remember the first time. Oh yeah, it was a ABC special, the Three Stooges. Oh man, that was a funny one. They wanted us to do a recording of the Curly Shuffle.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So I fly to LA. Richard wants me out there. So I go out there and I get to the studio and I walk in and Billy's on the session, you know. And of course, him and Richard go way back, which I'll have to tell you this story, but back in the late 50s, maybe early 60s, Richard had moved from Macon, Georgia to L.A., moved his whole family out there with him, you know. And he had bought Nat King Cole's old house, okay, so... One night, there's a knock on the door, and somebody goes to the door, and there's this little black kid standing there, maybe 14, 15 years old, looking for Mr. Cole. So Richard comes to the door, and Richard talks and invites him in and everything, and the kid says, yeah, I'm a big fan of Mr. Cole, and I just wanted to play my piano for him, you know? So Richard invited him in, and the kid sat down at the piano and just ripped it up, man. And turns out it was Billy Preston.
Holy crap, what a story.
So then Richard is getting ready to go to Hamburg, Germany, and invites Billy to go with him and play in the band.
At 15.
At 15, 16, whatever it was, young. So Billy goes to Europe with little Richard. And the Beatles are opening up some of the shows. So that's how Billy met the Beatles.
Wow.
So that's how that went down, you know.
That is so cool, man.
So anyway, I get back back to the Curly Shuffle. We go in, and Billy's on the B3. He's got two Leslies. And Richard starts singing real soft this old gospel song. You know, Richard loved gospel music. When he sang soft, man, it was so beautiful the way he did it, you know. But Billy chimed in on the B3, and I mean, I got chicken skin right now just thinking about how deep and how soulful it was, you know. It was amazing. So that was the first time I'd worked with Billy, you know. So really nice guy.
So innovative and so good at what he did, man.
Some people just are born with it, man. They're just born with the stank, as we like to say down here. You know, it's just oozes out of them, you know. And that, you know, him, Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, I mean, the list, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So. And all of those guys were deeply rooted with church music.
Deep in the church. I mean, that's kind of where it came from, you know. I mean, they go, mama takes them to church when you're real little. And it's just becomes a part of their body rhythm, you know.
So. Yeah. Neil Young.
Well, of course, I'd have to go back, you know, to how I got the gig with Peggy. Of course, you know, we're all Neil Young fans. I'm a big fan of his songwriting and guitar playing and going way back to Buffalo Springfield, you know. But my buddy Spooner Oldham has known Neil for a long time. He recorded and toured with him all the way back from the 70s, you know. And, of course, Spooner lives in the area, and we've been friends for a long time. But he had always told me that Peggy Young had a band, you know, Neil's wife had a band, and I didn't know that much about it, you know, other than what he told me, you know. So, long story short, they were getting ready to do a tour, Peggy was, and the guy that was playing guitar at the time had some sort of a issue at rehearsal and quit. I mean, that's kind of it in a nutshell. Just quit. And so they were kind of panicking, kind of wondering what they were going to do. And Spooner, you know, he's not big on recommending anybody to come play, because if they don't work out, he don't want to get blamed for it.
Yeah, I hear that.
But, you know, Spooner called his wife, Karen, and Karen said, well, what about Kelvin? You know, Spooner said, yeah. So can you call him? So I'm down here laying on the couch about half asleep. Karen calls and said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. She said, well, can you get on a plane? And then she told me what was going on. This is like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Can you get on a plane to go play for Neil Young?
Well, it wasn't Neil Young. It was Peggy.
Oh, it was Peggy. Okay.
Yeah. So, I said, well, how about I get on the first thing running in the morning? So I fly out to the ranch, which was, wow. I mean, I was just completely blown away by the ranch. You know, it's out in the middle of nowhere. It's beautiful. And
it's in California?
It's just south of Frisco, you know. But I get there, and I meet all the guys in the band and Peggy. And so we go to Neil's studio, and they got gear set up, and we start to play. We play two songs. I didn't know any of the songs. They had one of Neil's Gretsch White Falcons.
Wow.
And a old Tweed Deluxe, which on the Falcon, I'm just, it's, you know, I'm a Telly Strat Les Paul kind of guy and really wasn't used to playing a big fat Gretsch, you know. But anyway, she just looked at me and said, welcome to the family, you know. And it was great, you know. And I actually didn't meet Neil until the following day. And Neil was had some downtime, and so he would just hang out and play with us. You know, he was like the rhythm guitar player. And when he wasn't busy, he'd go with us to gigs and just, you know, we'd go out and play, and people would kind of look and go, damn, that's Neil Young up there playing. We'd be playing some bar somewhere, you know. And then, you know, we recorded together. He played on some of Peggy's stuff, and he was a great guy, man. Once I got over the initial shock of actually meeting him, but he was, you know, we got along good, you know. Funny guy, real dry sense of humor, you know.
Did you see that movie? I can't think of. It was a documentary where Neil was young, and he went into this store in California, and he's shopping for records, and there's a bootleg.
Yeah,
you see that? That was hilarious.
I've seen the video. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? You walk in, you see one of your records bootleg. Of course, nowadays everybody does it, you know.
Yeah, and he's like, "What is your name?" He's like a 17-year-old kid. He's like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "This is my record." And he's looking. He doesn't know who Neil Young is. That was the whole irony of it, you know.
Yeah,
it was
like, I know.
It was just very kind of abstract. The whole thing was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Did you get to work with him at all beyond Peggy stuff?
No, not really.
He just hung out. I mean,
at the time, he was doing. He was writing a book. And he was doing stuff with Crazy Horse, you know. Our bass player in Peggy's band, Rick Rosas, who passed away about 3 years ago, was Neil's bass player. But Neil was doing stuff with Crazy Horse at the time, you know.
I always thought that was his best band, man.
I always dug it too, man, you know. In fact, the band house at the ranch, we call the White House, kind of a ranch style house, but that's where we stayed. But Neil had an old board that he called the Blue Board. It was actually an old, I can't remember what the brand is, but it had knobs, old school knobs on it. It was actually the board that they used to record Cream's, Disraeli Gears album.
Wow.
And some of the album Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. But Neil owned that board, but he set up a makeshift control room in one of the bedrooms of the house there. And then they actually, him and Crazy Horse cut the whole record in the house.
Wow.
I think it was a Psychedelic Pill album they did a few years ago. But that was pretty cool.
That is cool, man.
Yeah.
How about Chris Christopherson?
Chris, I've just done a few gigs with him, mainly because of my buddy Donnie Fritz, who's a local legend songwriter. And Donnie was in Chris's band for like 20 years back in the 60s and 70s. And I was just part of the band when Chris came to town. We'd do like gigs with Donnie, and then Chris would show up. He would play. In fact, we just did a big show for Donnie. It was his 75th birthday, and Chris came, he and his wife, and we did a big show at the Shoals Theater. And Chris came into town earlier the following day, or the day before, rather. But my wife, Tanya, actually owns the second incarnation of Muscle Shoals Sound Studio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's owned it now almost 15 years. Great, great place. But I'd put a band together, and we were down at the studio kind of getting ready to rehearse, and then out of the blue, Chris shows up with Donnie. And comes in the studio and just starts playing great song after great song. We just sat there. We had our own little private Chris Christopherson concert, man. It was so cool.
That's awesome.
But there's been three or four other occasions over the years where I've played with him, you know. Once at the Bluebird in Nashville and a couple other places. I can't recall right now. But
any funny Chris stories?
Not really.
No.
Not really. I mean, he's a great guy. You know, funny, and that's, you know, I can't think of any funny stories.
Hey, I'm hoping you're a first call guy at that studio.
I get called a pretty good bit, you know.
That'd be a problem if you're not a first call guy at your wife's studio, Kelvin.
Depends on how things are here at the house.
I hear that, brother. I hear that. I feel you on that one, man. Ronnie Wood. That I didn't expect that name to pop up.
Well, that's another one off. You know, we were in London doing a. This is a funny one too. We were doing a TV show over there in London called The White Room, and it was Little Richard, Robert Palmer, and some other band. Actually became real famous after that. I can't remember. Not Oasis, but somebody like that. But Richard says, Calvin, Ronnie Wood is coming to play with us.
Did he always call you Calvin?
He always called me Calvin, you know, which is fine, you know. I said, I always would tell him, just spell my name right on the check.
On the paycheck. Yeah, man, I hear you.
But I said, great, you know. And so there, I mean, we get there and there's Ronnie, man. And I go in his dressing room. He's got a keg of Guinness in there. I've never had Guinness in my life. And he poured me a pint and he was great, you know. And anyway, a long story short, we get on stage and Ronnie's got two guitars set up right next to me. I think one was tuned to slide, like an open G tuning or E, and the other one was tuned regular, you know. So he comes out and we're doing like Lucille and Tutti Frutti or something like that. Ronnie picks up the slide guitar and tries to play it in standard tuning, and it was just way off, you know. I mean, we're all looking around at each other like, what in the world's going on?
Yeah.
Rich is looking over at us, and Ronnie's just rocking out, man. He doesn't even, he doesn't even realize what's going on, you know. So I think that's another YouTube find you can see, you know.
That's funny, man. Maybe it was the Guinness had something to do with that.
It could have been. I think at that time he was, you know, on the Guinness, amongst other things, you know. And Robert Palmer was there with his band. It was his birthday, so I think everybody was feeling pretty good, you know.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's wild. Was it weird playing with a Rolling Stone?
Well...
Or not once he played, once he started playing and you heard them. What was?
You know, any situation like that where you get to hang and or actually get to play with people you kind of grew up listening to, you go, okay, this is cool.
Yeah.
And then once you're in the moment, you know, you just turn into the other, you're just a guitar player.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's just a guitar player and we're having a good time, you know? And, so yeah, you know, that's kind of what that is.
And how about Greg Allman, one of my all-time favorite musicians?
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was a huge Brothers fan back in when they first came out. I liked everything, almost everything that came out of Capricorn Records in Macon, Georgia.
For sure, man.
And I'll have to. Johnny Sandlin, who was a house producer there all those years, produced the Brothers, produced Wet Willie, a lot of the bands that were on that label Johnny had his hand in, you know. But after Capricorn folded, Johnny moved back to Decatur, Alabama, and had a studio behind his house, you know, and he also started that band, The Decoys. Of course, I knew who Johnny Sandlin was. I'd never met him. I didn't know anything about his personal life. I didn't even know he was from Decatur, to be honest with you, you know. And one day out of the blue, man, he calls, you know. It was just another one of those Little Richard kind of moments where you just get a phone call. He said he had a band called The Decoys, and would I be interested? He got my number from somebody. Would I be interested in come jamming with him? And I said, shoot, yeah, you know. So I came over there, and that's how I got that gig, was with The Decoys. And, of course, we're still carrying the torch. You know, Johnny passed away last year, and but in that band was Scott Boyer. Scott Boyer was a member of the band Cowboy.
Oh, yeah, okay, I know them. Dwayne Allman did
Boyer and Talton. Yeah. They're on that Greg Allman Live album, you know. And so, me, Scott, Johnny on bass, and we had a keyboard player and a drummer. And Scott Boyer just passed away about 3 months ago, and I'm the only original guy left. Everybody else is gone. But back to Greg, I think it was around 91, 92, Johnny was going to produce a record on him, you know. So Greg came to Decatur, and we worked on a record with him for, God, close to a year. It wasn't one of Greg's best periods, you know, I'll just say that.
Right.
I'm going to go into all that other stuff that everybody knows about already, but
yeah.
It was a rough go for Greg, and it was a rough go for us, you know, too. So, but you know, we did the record, and we actually did a few gigs with him, you know. And so that's how the Greg Allman thing came about, you know.
Which record was that, if you remember?
Searching for Simplicity.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it was me. Guitars on there is pretty much me, Jack Pearson, and Derek Trucks.
Oh, my Derek, God, what a lineup.
Yeah, Derek was all of maybe 15. I can remember sitting across from him in the studio and swapping eights on a blues song, you know. And he was just playing his ass off then, too, you know, so.
Incredible musician, just phenomenal.
Oh, he's another guy that was born into it, you know, but to me, he's kind of taken slide guitar to where Dwayne probably would have ended up, because he was so into Coltrane and all that stuff, you know. And of course, Derek's kind of got that Indian influence in his playing too, you know. So,
and he uses it so appropriately.
Oh yeah, man!
You know, it's so tasteful.
There's very few guitar players in my book today that I can hear and say, okay, that's so-and-so. That's so-and-so. But if I hear Derek, I go, okay, that's Derek.
Yeah.
You know, or that's Jeff Beck, you know, or that's Pat Metheny, or that, you know. But a lot of the music now, the mainstream stuff, especially that comes out of Nashville, or I can't recognize anybody's playing, you know.
Sure,
everybody just kind of coming from the same school, you know. So,
well, man, this is really weird. I interviewed a guy, Kirk McKim, the other day. He played with Pat Travers, and he sent me an article, like I think from the LA Times. Apparently, there's been a whole thing that they're deliberately eliminating guitar solos, because what they reckon is that people don't have the attention span to want to listen to a guitar solo, and it clutters things up.
Well, God, I don't know what to say.
I know. That's how I felt.
I can almost relate to it, man. We're living in an instant gratification society, man, where everybody's so used to getting it over with. You know, I don't know.
Yes.
I mean, to me, music will always just be music, you know. I don't know about that, you know. I think there's always going to be a place for... Of course, you know, nowadays I hear stuff that my kids listen to, and what's mainstream, and I'm just like, wow, now I know what my parents felt like.
Yeah.
Stones and Hendrix and all this, you know, what they called race music back in the day, you know, all the blues and my, you know, but yeah, I feel the same way, man. I'm like, wow, man.
I know. That's exactly what I said. I didn't even know how do you process that information? Like, what are you supposed to do with that information? Because to me,
I don't know, man. You pull up to a stop sign and the rear end of your car is about to fall off because some guy with subwoofers is in the trunk. is just rattling the pavement, you know.
Yeah. So. I know, it's weird. And then so, because I don't want to listen to something unless it has guitar solos in there.
Man, I'm the same way, you know.
You know, I know.
I mean, I do listen to the new stuff, you know, as much as I can. But for the most part, man, I'm listening to the same stuff I've been listening to for 50 years, you
yeah,
know.
So. Yeah, I hear you. You've been involved in so much. Would it be possible for you, Kelvin, to like say what your top three experiences have been musically, either because of the work you did or the, you know, the coolness of the hang that was around, or you know, just.
God, there's just been so many. You know, definitely the grand opening of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was very cool. We did that with Little Richard, you know, at the Cleveland Browns football stadium there. I think it was aired on HBO, but everybody was there, and it was just so great to see all these performers on one stage, man. And you know, of course, you get to meet some of your musical heroes, you know. Some of them turned out to be just like you thought they would be, and some of them didn't, you know. But definitely that one. God, it's just hard to think, man. There's just been so many. You know, Klaus Voormann, that was, you know, I'd seen Klaus's name for years and years, and never thought much about him being a bass player, you know. I always thought of him as an artist, you know.
Mm.
But he was a great bass player. But me and David Hood.
Another bass player, right?
Yeah, he's one of the Swampers. You
yeah.
know, he's actually our bass player in the Decoys. You know, David and I. Really good buddies and play a lot of music together, do a lot of sessions together. But we have a mutual friend in Memphis, Don Nix. Don Nix wrote, remember the song Going Down?
Yeah, of course.
Jeff Beck did yeah. it. I mean, it's been done to death, you know. But Don's a longtime Memphis guy. And apparently, you know, Don goes back to George Harrison. He played with George Harrison and... So I think that's where he met Klaus. But Klaus was doing a solo record, man. It was all about his musical journey, and he kind of split it up in different sections. Like, he came to Memphis and did a thing. We did two tracks with him. Klaus didn't play at all. He just produced it, and he wanted David to play the bass. And it was with Bonnie Bramlett.
Wow.
And then he left Memphis and he went to like London. He went to McCartney's place and got Paul on there. He got Ringo on there. Cat Stevens is on there. I mean, it's a really good album, you know. I don't know if it ever really saw the light of day, but it was really well done, you know. But just, you know, hanging with him and talking about the Beatle days. And one morning, I think the second day we were in the studio, I walked in the studio and there was a box on top of the grand piano. Out of curiosity, I kind of popped the top off of it. And it was all this artwork. And it was Klaus's artwork, signed and numbered, you know. So I kind of started kind of looking at it. And he came in there and he goes, "You can have that, you know." And I looked at him perplexed. He goes, "Yeah, you can have anything in there you want, you know." So me and David went in there, and we got, like, I don't know, five or six original Klaus Voormann paintings, you know. Of course, you know, he did the artwork for the Revolver album and played bass in Manfred Mann's band and John Lennon's Plastic Ono band, you know.
You know, they did a movie about him called All You Need Is Klaus, and I keep looking for it on...
I heard about that.
Yeah. You know? I keep looking for it on Netflix and Amazon, and I never... Because I got this thing, a list of movies that, you know, once every 3-4 months pops up, and I really want to see that, and I have found neither hide nor hair of it.
Yeah, I mean, Klaus goes all the way back to the beginning of the Beatles. You know,
yeah.
They were in Hamburg, you know, that's where he first... But you know... I spent, you know, 2 or 3 days in the studio with him, and by the end of those 3 days, we were buddies, you know.
Yeah.
And to this day, every Christmas, he sends me and David a hand-drawn Christmas card.
Man, how cool is that?
Yeah, how cool is that?
That is awesome, you know, man.
Every now and then we'll get an email from him, or, you know, just a super, super nice cat, man. So
that's so cool, man. So you say Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Klaus will be number three.
And probably, you know, being in the studio with Neil and Little Richard and Bobby Bland and, you know, all those people, it's always special, you know, to get to work with people like that, you know.
Awesome. Are you originally from Muscle Shoals?
No, I'm not, man. I've been here about 25, 26 years. My dad was Air Force. So I spent my younger years up around the Nashville area, you know. And then we were transferred overseas to Turkey.
Oh, wow. That's so different.
We lived in Turkey from I was about 13 when we moved there. Then my dad did a year in Vietnam. My mother's German, and she's from Munich, Germany. So my father was in Vietnam for that year. We moved to Munich and lived there for a year. And that's where I saw my first concert, which was John Mayall.
How cool is that, man?
Yeah, it was like...
Who was his guitar player at the time? Was it Mick Taylor?
You know what? It was during his acoustic phase. You know, he had, I think, Mark Almond and just some other guys. I can't remember who was on there. But Mayall played a lot of the guitar and harmonica, you know. And I think he played piano every now and then, you know. But it was just because it was my first concert, and I had just heard the Blues Breakers album with Clapton.
Yeah. You know?
So, and I wasn't really, I mean, I was playing, but I wasn't really playing, you know, but after Cream came out, that's when I really started digging in, you know.
What was living in Turkey like, or were you on a base with Americans, so it really wasn't this?
No, actually we lived out. What they called it, out on the economy is what they called it. You know, we lived amongst the Turks, you know. We lived in a big apartment building with Turkish people, you know. And some of my best buddies at that time were Turks, you know. Mm-hmm. And but that was transformative in the fact that, you know, there was so much good music coming out then, you know. It was always an event when the Beatles put out a record, or the Stones or Cream or The Who. I was really into British invasion, you know. I didn't know diddly squat about the blues, man. And I'd look on a record and say, you know, written by McKinley Morganfield or Chester Burnett. And I'm like, who in the hell are these people, you know?
Right.
And then you find out, well, it's Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
You know? So they really, you know, they kind of turned us back onto our own music, you know. So
very much. Do you know who Bob Margolin is?
I do.
Yeah, I interviewed Bob the other day, and you know, he was just talking.
Muddy for a long time.
Yeah. This was Muddy for 6 or 7 years, I think, and some pretty interesting stories. So that's interesting. So you sent in from Munich. Where did you guys go after that?
Well, my father came back from Nam. He met us in Munich, and we got orders. They call the order. You're gonna, you know, it's where you're gonna be stationed, you know. But it was McCord Air Force Base in Tacoma, Washington.
Oh,
right?
Wow!
So we were all prepared to go to Tacoma, Washington. At the last minute, they changed it to Montgomery, Alabama, Maxwell Air Force Base.
Okay.
So, 1970, in fact, it was on my birthday, September 1970, we moved to Montgomery, Alabama, and it was like pure culture shock, you know.
Coming from Munich?
Coming from living overseas for 3 years, and you don't know anybody, and, you know, it's right in the middle of all the racial stuff, and...
Oh, that's right. That was big shit going on at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty heavy duty, man. You know, so that's when I really got into playing guitar. The guitar became my best friend, you know.
Well, I would imagine being new to a place that literally was your best friend. You didn't know anybody.
I didn't know anybody. Yeah. And I eventually made some close friends. And long story short, I barely got through high school because I was so into music. That's all I wanted to do. The best band in town at the time offered me a job, and on my 18th birthday, I moved out of my parents' house and into a band house, and I've been doing it ever since.
Good for you, man. Were your folks okay with that originally, or were they like typical?
Hell
like,
no.
Yeah.
You know, to me, this whole business is just, I guess if you're a journeyman musician, I guess that's what I would consider myself. You know, you get on a bus and you ride it until it stops. And then hopefully there's another bus waiting that you can get on. The bus being just gigs.
Yeah.
And situations, you know, so.
Well, you must, you've been very consistent and you've been in, you know, it's in some great situations. So that means that you're a good player and you're a good hang and you're easy to deal with.
Well, I guess.
Well, if I asked your wife if you were easy to deal with, what would she say?
I wouldn't ask her.
Pick another person. You've gone back and forth quite a lot over your career between blues and, like, I hate this term, but this is what they call it now, Americana.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why I don't like that term, but it's,
I'm not a big fan of it. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I consider myself just blues, rock, R&B,
yeah.
You know. So, I mean, that's what I listen to, and that's what I've become, you know. Mm. So. I'm not technically great. I don't know technically that much about music. I play from whatever I'm feeling, you know. I don't think about things too much musically. It's just, I pull it, like I said earlier, I just pull it out of the cloud. It's like the other day I did a solo on a session on somebody's song, and the producer says, man, just let it rip. So we get to the section. I took one pass and I see them in there throwing their arms up. And I just kind of said, was that cool? Hell yeah, man, you're done. I mean, it took all of 40 seconds once I had strapped the guitar on, you know. So yeah. There you go.
What are some, did you ever have, like, I mean, I know you had them, everybody has, what are some obstacles you've had to deal with or challenges that you've had to overcome throughout this journey?
God, that's a tough one. I mean, there's always obstacles, you know, and everybody goes through them, you know. But right off the hand, I can't think of any, you know, outside of learning maybe a piece of music that I was booked on a show and there's a 7-page chart. You know what I mean?
And you got a half hour.
I mean, I can read a number chart, but once you get into the staff and all that stuff,
right?
You know, I have to improvise. You know, I'll learn the chord changes and whatnot, but the rest, I got to improvise.
Sure.
But, you know, that can be kind of stressful sometimes. You're kind of out of your comfort zone, you know, so.
Yeah, that's a very common thing that a lot of players have had to deal with. And it's funny, the guys that are super experience like you often, they a lot of times say, if I had to look back, I wish I was able to read better. But you know, like, it's, I think it's more of like a, well, I would have felt like I was a better musician. But all the guys that say that have been like so freaking busy, like you know.
Yeah, you know, I just don't, I'm not in that mindset, you know. I never was one to sit around and practice scales. I mean, if I heard something, I would go, man, I got to learn that. It's like,
yeah.
You know, you hear a chord. I remember when Steely Dan first came out, you know. I mean, it was like the first band I ever heard that had all these,
oh, yeah.
You know, demolished in chords and all this stuff, you know, and there you get as close as you could, because you know you couldn't go on YouTube back then and get a guitar lesson from somebody, you know. You had to rely on your ears, and in my case there would always be one note that was kind of off, you know. I was like, man, I'm missing a note, what is it, you know. It's like the Beatles telling that story, I think Paul and George got on a bus in Liverpool one day, went all the way across town somewhere because somebody knew the B7 chord, you know?
So, but you know, Steely Dan's like the worst band to, you know, what guitar player didn't try to figure that out and get it right? That's impossible. Yeah, I
mean, absolutely. That's, man, impossible, you know, man. Larry Carlton, I mean, God, you know, wow. Some really tasty playing right there, you know.
Oh God, yeah. If you could go back, Kelvin, and give your younger self advice, assuming you might have listened, what advice would you have given yourself?
Oh God, man, I don't regret any. You know, we all make bad decisions in life, you know.
Absolutely.
But picking music as a profession wasn't a bad decision on my. You know, yeah, I'm not rich, I'm not famous, but I get to play music with friends. You know, that's how I started. I started in the garage playing with friends, and we had a great time, and I just wanted it to continue, you know. And so I'm still doing it, you know, after 50 years, I'm still doing it. I'm still having a great time. Yeah, granted, a lot of times you're tired. Sometimes you just kind of feel like you're going through the motions, or you're burnt out, you're jet lagged, or whatever. But once you get on stage, man, all of that goes away, you know. I mean, Little Richard would be in such pain with his hips and his legs. And once he got out on the stage, man, you forget about it. You forget about it. It's just like this block in your brain that just blocks out the pain, you know.
Sure. So
it's a natural painkiller. I always call music a natural painkiller, you know.
I like that. Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. Guitar-wise, what is your go-to guitar right now, and what other couple of guitars might round out your top three?
Well, you know, I've always kind of been a Fender Gibson guy, you know, but I've got a G&L Tele that I've been playing for like 15 years that feels like home. You know, all guitars are different. They all feel different in whoever's hand. Some guy likes a fat neck, some guy likes a V-neck. I know what feels good to me.
What do you like? What kind of neck do you like?
Just a C-shaped neck. It doesn't have to be real fat. It just has to feel right, you know. And when G&L sent this one years ago, it was great right out of the box, you know. I mean, it's a great telly, man. That's all I can say. It sounds great. I haven't done anything to it. Stock pickups. I'm playing it through a Magnetone Twilighter, which is a great amp, you know.
Was it like a 30 watt?
It's like a 22 watt. It's kind of like a souped up deluxe reverb is the only way I can put it. But it's real touch sensitive, you know. You know, I'm a big volume guy on the guitar, you know. So, you know, I'll turn the volume down for like rhythms. If I want to rip, I'll jack it up, you know. Past couple of weeks, I've gotten a couple of nice old Blackface Fenders, I got this 65 Deluxe non-reverb, and I got a 65 Tremolux.
Wow. Where'd you find those? Were you shopping for them, or they just something to pop?
Well,
pop?
No. I mean, actually, I traded some stuff for them.
I was going to say, that's hell of a couple of weeks there, man.
There's a friend of mine in town, Don Parker. He has Shoals Guitar Boutique. But he's got a lot of nice, cool, old vintage stuff in there. But he had these Fenders. But he had the Blackface Deluxe, and he had a brown Deluxe. I plugged in the brown one, and it kind of farted. You know, I didn't like it. Real muddy. And I plugged into the Blackface, and it just I hit one chord and it just chimed, you know. I was like, oh wow, that's it, you know. So that's how I ended up that. But I've recently just got back a Marshall amp that I bought brand new 40 years ago.
Wow.
And I played it for probably 15 years, a 50-watt combo, great sounding amp. And I sold it to a buddy here in town probably 25 years ago. And it just showed up at Don's shop like 2 weeks ago. I was sitting there, because mind you, it was a combo amp. It was in a 212 enclosure, right? Well, my buddy apparently had taken the chassis out and put it inside a 50-watt box, you know, head. But I was sitting in the store looking at it going, wow, I used to have an amp that kind of looked like that. I walked around behind it, and I went, wow, I used to have an amp just like this. And Don goes, yeah, it used to belong to so-and-so. And I go, this is my amp. You know?
So you bought it back.
So I got it back, man. After, you know, I bought it new in 78, you know.
How's it sound? So,
it still sounds great. Oh. But I'm playing the G&L. I got a Strat. A friend, a good friend in L.A., record producer, gifted me with a Gretsch 6120, which I've been wanting one since I was a kid, because there was a guy in our neighborhood when I was little. This is before I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or any of that, but on most Sunday afternoons, he would come out on the front porch with a orange 6120 and an old Gibson amp and play like Chet Atkins. And I just thought it was the greatest sound I ever heard, you know. And ever since then, I'd always wanted an orange 6120, and my friend gifted it to me on my birthday, man.
Man, how cool is that? That's a very
Yeah, it was very awesome. Cool. I'm still excited about it. But I got, you know, and a Les Paul. So those are kind of my three or four main axes, you know.
Just talk about your Les Paul. Is it what year?
It's a 94, just a standard, but it feels great. Sounds great. Cherry Sunburst standard.
Let me ask you this. And it may not be a possible question, but how does your G&L Tele, or how does a G&L product differ from a Fender product, or can you really not generalize because it's guitar to guitar?
Well, they're both Leo Fender. You know, I think, of course, in the beginning when Leo was building guitars, it was a lot of Leo in there. And as time went on, I think Leo had a lot less to do with the design of the guitars, you know. And then when he formed G&L, I think it was all Leo again, you know. But to me, the quality's better on a G&L.
Can you be specific? Like what aspects?
Just the overall construction and the feel of the wood, you know. It doesn't look so manufactured, you know, or it doesn't feel so manufactured, I guess. It just feels like somebody put some love into it. You know, usually you'll have to do a Fender custom shop, you know. But like I said, all guitars feel different. Like sure. I'm playing a USA standard Strat, and I've had several of them over the years, and I've gotten rid of every one of them. I just found this one, and it feels great. It sounds great stock. I'm a big fan of, if I find a stock guitar that sounds great, you know, I don't want to have to do all this stuff to it.
Yeah, yeah. I
want to get this latest mod and buy the hottest pickup that that so and so's using, and I want to get my sound out of the guitar the way it is, you know.
Yeah. So, I've got a Fender, I've got a Tele, and I don't really enjoy it. I'd love to swap it for a G&L. It's relatively new and great. I don't even play it very much. It's kind of a shame, but I would love to find it. Everybody.
Well, I've got a few guitars like that myself. You know, you find yourself playing what feels good. So
yeah,
I always try to tell the young guys, man, if you find a guitar, because I have sold so many guitars over the years that I wish I'd have kept. I could probably retire, you know, but, If you got a guitar that you love and an amp that you love, try to hang on to it, man. I know times get tough sometimes. you know, or you want this, or, but, you know, it's a journey too. Finding gear is a journey. Finding stuff that you like is as much of a journey as playing music. So, you know,
for sure, man. Musically, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and just for this moment, knowing that they could change tomorrow, what would be your knee-jerk reaction?
Yeah, reaction, man. There's just so many. I'd have to go with Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, Jeff Beck, Blow by Blow, probably the Revolver album by the Beatles, anything by Pat Metheny. I'm a big fan of instrumental music, you know?
Sure.
There's something about, you hear a piece of music instrumentally that moves you so much that you just start crying, you know what I mean?
It's very raw. It's very,
very raw, man. Yeah. But when the Blow by Blow album came out, it was the first instrumental album I heard, and the way he had it sequenced, and every song ran into the next song, and with the drums, usually, I think it was Bernard Purdy. But that album, to me, was life-changing. I immediately went from Live at the Fillmore with the Allman Brothers to that, you know, so.
That's a great album. That and Wired,
Wired.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I think Wired was Max Middleton on drums,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great, incredible. To come out with those two albums, like, back-to-back, that's pretty nutty.
It could have been a double album, you know, yeah. Wired and Blow by Blow, so.
What have you learned most about yourself throughout this entire musical journey?
That I'm only human. You know, I can't be all things to all people at all times. You know, I mean, of course, you know, when you get to a gig or a session or one, you want to be the best you can be, you know, but you can't force inspiration, you know. So.
No, I think that's an important lesson, because you got to be it's important to be forgiving and, even though you're demanding of yourself, it's important to be forgiving and tolerant of yourself, you know?
Yeah, you can't beat yourself up, man. You don't. Yeah. You just try not to take it too serious, or you're going to hurt yourself. You're going to be setting yourself up for some major letdowns, you know?
Yeah, and the bar, you keep raising it higher and higher to an impossible.
Sure, man. Yeah. Of course, you always want to be as good as you can be, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Best childhood memory.
Wow, best childhood memory.
You had a really interesting childhood, moving all over the place.
Yeah, probably my grandmother's biscuits and gravy.
Way to go. That's spoken like a true Southerner,
man.
Yeah, man.
I mean, she was she had a whole drawer that was just full of flour and lard. You had to have the lard.
That's so funny.
And she would make this white gravy in a cast iron skillet from the grease from the bacon, you know.
Nice.
But, yeah, that and you know, the life-changing moment for me was watching that neighbor with the Gibson amp and the Gretsch guitar and a bottle of Jim Beam. I mean, that changed me. That and, of course, seeing the Beatles, you know, on Ed Sullivan, you know, that's I'm sure you've had many interviews where guys have cited that show, you know, as inspiration, you know. Seemed like everybody, the next day after that was on, everybody started a band, you know.
You know, Kelvin, I would say in your age bracket, because we're about 12, 13 years apart, I suspect.
Right.
I would say 90% of all the players cite that. Seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
What was the first time you saw a band?
Yeah.
It was four guys that were buddies. And the songs were great. They were great pop songs. It was unlike anything you'd ever heard, you know. Not to mention the fact that the girls are
girls, strong. Yeah, right, right.
You're like, wow, look at that. Wow.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's what every guy says, man.
You know, I mean, you could be the most unpopular guy in school, man. Once they found out you could play guitar, hey, man, you were the guy. Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right up there with the quarterback of the high school football team, man.
Or higher.
or higher, you know. So.
Yeah, it was like a way for the sort of the outcasts or the guys that were isolated, and everybody feels that way as a teenager, you know, you just think you're the only one who feels that way. It was a way for all the people like that to suddenly get popularity.
Right, right.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Wow. I don't really know, man. I love to cook.
Oh, that's cool. That's nice.
I mean, if I wasn't a musician, I would probably be a chef or a truck driver.
What do you like to cook?
I love to drive, too, man. I love to get in the car and just go, you know. So,
what do you like to cook?
Anything.
Really?
Well, not. I'm not gourmet or anything. I just soul food. You know, the meat and three.
Yeah.
You know.
Better watch out. I like that. Better watch out. If I come to Muscle Shoals, I'll be having expectations now.
We've got a few good places here in town that can throw it at you.
Happiest moment or time in your life?
Well, it would have to be when my children were born, you know. I don't think anything beats that, you know.
Most important thing your dad taught you?
Just always do the best job you could do. I mean, I remember when he would ask me to go wash the car, you know, and he would come out and look at it after I did it, and he'd see I missed a spot, you know, and he would scold me for for missing a spot. He goes, always make sure you do a good job, you know.
Yeah.
So that's probably the most important thing that he taught me, you know. So dad wasn't around a lot, you know. I mean, he worked all the time. He was in the Air Force, and he would always have like two or three other jobs along with that. And then when he retired from the Air Force, he started working for the Postal Service. So, I mean, he wasn't around a lot, you know. So.
How about your mom? Most important thing she taught you?
My mom had a lot of balls, you know. She probably taught me more about that than anything, you know. My mom grew up in Nazi Germany and came here, and she endured a lot, you know.
Wow. She's
a very, very strong woman, you know. She just made 87, and she's still kicking butt, you know.
Man, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Her memory is better than mine, you know.
That's
without a doubt. So.
She live near you?
She lives in north of Nashville.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's great, man. Congratulations. 87. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
No, I thought about taking up crocheting, but I didn't took a pass on that.
Two more questions, man. Most important lesson that your business has taught you?
Probably just, you know, don't be an asshole, you know.
Yeah.
And just try to give 100%. You know, I know some days you just can't. You know, I mean, it's just part of being human, you know. But just try to be on your game, you know.
Did you – I'm sure you knew or played with or around – was I think his name was Barry Beckett?
I didn't know Barry, man. Barry, by the time I moved here Barry had already moved to Nashville. I mean, the way I met all those guys, the Swampers, which was Barry Beckett, Roger Hawkins, David Hood, and Jimmy Johnson. But to go back to the band, the Decoys, we played every Tuesday night at a club here, and it was always packed with musicians and just people in general. I mean, out of the blue one night on a break, I was outside talking to somebody, and the guy came up, said, "Hey, man, great playing, you know." And I'm Jimmy Johnson, and I'm like, "Wow, man, it's great to meet you." You know, I mean, you know, some of my favorite records had their names on written all over them all the time. You know, stuff I liked. You know, he says, "Man, we're cutting Bobby Blue Bland tomorrow. Why don't you come down? You know, and bring your amp and guitar and." So I did, man, and I played the whole record.
Wow.
So that was my first session here in Muscle Shoals was with Bobby, you know.
That's so. pretty impressive.
So ever since then, you know, we're all buzzing. But they would come in the club, and especially Roger and David, and I would always try to get them up to play, and they would, no, man, we just want to listen. We don't know the songs. And, you know, we're used to reading charts. And I said, man, we're just playing like some blues songs. Come on, you know. And finally, Roger got up first, you know, after a and he played, and then finally David played. And at one point, we had Roger and David as our rhythm section in the band.
Nice.
Which was pretty cool. And yeah. Roger had neck surgery and couldn't play. And then, but David's been with us ever since, you know.
That's wonderful, man.
So, going on a long time, so.
Reason I asked you about Barry is you made up, you said, don't be an asshole. Apparently, I had interviewed very, very long time ago, I interviewed a Nashville session player named, I don't know if you know Mike Durham.
I know the name.
Phenomenal player. I mean, just jaw-dropping. Mm-hmm. And he was doing a lot of work at Shoals, and or maybe this was in Nashville, but he said Barry, no, it was in Muscle Shoals, because he said Barry had a sign outside his office, and it said something to the effect of, be careful, be careful whose toes you step on,
right,
on the way up, because they may be attached to the ass you need to kiss on the way down. Was that's true?
Well, that is very true. I mean, it's like the line in there's a Little Feet song, the same people you misuse on your way up, you might meet up on your way down.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that's what, when you said don't be an asshole, that reminded me of.
That's one of Willie Nelson's big things too, is don't be an asshole, you know. We did a couple of tours with him and his band, you know, great people.
When you were with Richard?
No, with Peggy Young.
With Peggy Young.
We did a couple of tours with Willie. We did a couple with Stephen Stills. But yeah, they're all really nice people, you know.
Last question, man, and I really appreciate you sharing all your stories and telling your story.
Yeah, I've enjoyed talking to you, man.
Likewise. What do you say, Kelvin's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change has been deliberate, and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
I don't know that my personality's changed, man. I'm a practical joker, and I can be pretty sarcastic at times, you know. It's like when Will and I play, you know, I mean, I'm constantly cutting up. Like, I'll show... There's a chord, actually a friend of mine showed it to me about 2 or 3 months ago, but I was on a break at a gig, and he said, he's a guitar repair guy. I've been using him for years. He's great.
It's not Dennis Shaw, is it?
No, it's a guy named Tommy Shepherd in Huntsville, Alabama.
Hmm.
Great, good buddy. I mean, he can fix a guitar, you know. There's guys like that out there that you haven't really heard about, you know, but they know their stuff, and Tommy's one of them. But we were on a break. He goes, hey, man, you know the James Bond chord? And I went, the James Bond chord? And, of course, you know, I've seen all the Bond movies. And he goes, yeah, you know that chord that's in the movies, you know? And then he goes, he said, I don't know the name of it, you know, but he went up and grabbed my Gretsch.
Yeah. He's got his orange Gretsch. God, is that a gorgeous guitar, man.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
He hits this chord. It's this chord right here. Listen to it. He goes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like when they would change scenes.
Yeah.
Movie, you know, and they'd hit that. You know, and then come to find out, it's an E minor major 7 or a major 9 or something like that. But I've been showing every guitar player that I've been running across lately the James Bond chord, you know. But one night, when I think after I learned it, any song that we played in the key of E, me and Will, we'd end it with that.
With the James Bond chord. That's so funny, man.
Yep.
Where's your pointers? Is that on B?
Yeah, well, you got to get that open, that low E string. But get your pinky on the G note on the A string.
Mm-hmm.
And then go to the D and just half step it all the way down to the B string.
Gotcha.
It almost looks like a major 7 chord, you know, but.
Okay, cool. So you're just going, okay. That's very, so you're, right. So you're going 7, 8, 9, 10 fret.
Right.
All the way up ascending. Very cool, man.
Yeah.
James Bond chord. Awesome. Yeah. Got a guitar lesson today. Oh, that's the real deal, man.
Do it
to it, brother. let me tell people where they can get a hold of you. First of all, Kelvin, thank you so much for everything, man. And what an amazing, really cool musical history you have, man. And I wish you
I've had a nice little journey, man.
I wish you nothing but continued success and
I appreciate everything.
Man. Are you going to be at NAMM? Any chance?
It just depends. I usually make up the last minute decision, you know. I've really been, you know, sort of involved with these Magnetone amps. Mm. They're great amplifiers. Of course, you know, Magnetone has a hell of a history going all the way back to the 30s, 40s, 50s. You know, a lot of people played through them. But my buddy Ted Kornblum, out of St. Louis, started the company back up. You know, he bought all the copyrights and the rights and all that, and making some great, great amps, you know.
So. Well, man, if you're going to be up there, let me know, because I'll be up there the first day. We can bump into you, have a drink or a cigar or whatever it is.
Yeah, that sounds good, man.
And let me tell people where to find you. First of all, if anybody is looking for session work and Muscle Shoals and wants an amazing... like an amazingly talented guitarist who's not an asshole.
I appreciate it.
Hit up.
I am not an asshole.
Certified, not an asshole. Hit up Kelvin Holly, and you can find him on Facebook or Instagram. It's Kelvin, K-E-L-V-I-N, Holly, H-O-L-L-Y. And
no E in Holly, thank you.
Yeah, no E, and... you'll more than get your money's worth, man. This guy's been around the block and then some. So check him out again, Facebook or Instagram. And in the Shoals area, you have a standing gig every like Tuesday, right?
Yeah, every Tuesday, man. Me and Will, we got a band called Fathers and Sons. It's me and him and his son Jamie on bass, and another good buddy Justin Holder on drums, and Will's wife Janet comes and sings harmony, and we just. We play like from 6:30 to 9:30, man. I'm about 5 minutes from my house, you know. So
it's the baby boomer crowd. We'll get you in bed by 10.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, man.
Where do you play? What's the name of
the place?
Yeah.
It's called Flow Bama.
Great. So anybody's in Muscle Shoals, go to Flow Bama on Tuesday nights. You get to see Will, who I interviewed, Will McFarlane, and Kelvin. Some great guys and really cool players, man. And tell him you heard him here on the show, and he'll show you the James Bond chord in person.
Right on. Everybody needs to know that one.
Absolutely. You know what I'm doing as soon as this is over? I'm going to pick up my guitar. I swear.
I've had guys actually texting me like in the middle of the night because they're so frustrated they can't figure it out. You know, I finally just took a picture of the cord and I would just text that back to them, you know. So.
That's great, man. Hey, man, thank you for everything. I really appreciate it. You're a hell of a nice guy. And
yeah, you too, man. I appreciate it, man. It was a lot of fun.
Cool, man. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I hope you had half as much fun as I did. Thanks again to Kelvin Holly for spending all his time with us and sharing himself and his stories. Great stuff. I really appreciate that. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com, sign up and get on our newsletter list, get notified of future episodes and product announcements and all that good stuff. And remember, this is important. Remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar, and most important, have some fun, man. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.